Hello, I'm Oliver Wong.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. You're listening to Heat Rocks.
Every episode, we invite a guest to join us to talk about Heat Rock, a record seared into their memory. And today, Heat Rocks finally makes the mothership connection, as we'll be talking about Parliament's 1976 LP, The Clones of Dr. Funkenstein.
Ow!
Listen. Funk upon a time, in the days of the Funkopus, the concept of specially designed Afro knots capable of funkatizing galaxies was first laid on man-child, but was later repossessed and placed among the secrets of the pyramids until a more positive attitude towards this most sacred phenomenon, clone funk, could be acquired.
The Star Wars franchise depicts the adventures of characters in a galaxy where many species of aliens, often humanoid, coexist with droids. It's about space travel and a mystical power known as the Force that is an energy field binding the galaxy together. The Parliament franchise depicts the adventures of characters in a galaxy where many species of aliens, often humanoid like Sir Nose and Dr. Funkenstein, coexist with droids like the Afronauts. It's about space travel via the mothership connection and a mystical power known as the Funk that is an energy field binding the galaxy together. The second in a trilogy of albums that began just 7 months before, The Clones of Dr. Funkenstein picks up where the previous album leaves off. It's a continued fight for funk's freedom and preservation, a fight to rid your mind of cobwebs via the funk, and the pervasive thought being, free your mind and your ass will follow. To do this, Bernie, Bootsy, Maceo, Fred, Taka Boom, and others moved and grooved across 9 tracks of sick bass lines and horns and vocals. This album went gold, Parliament's second album to be certified as such. And on July 20th, 1976, George Clinton and Casablanca Records presented their vision of funk's new world order, one nation, under a groove, indivisible, with sonic liberty and justice for all.
There in these terrestrial projects, it would wait alone with its co-inhabitants of kings and pharaohs, like sleeping beauties, for the kiss that would release them to multiply in the image of the chosen one, Dr. Funkenstein. And funk is its own reward. May I frighten you?
The Clones of Dr. Funkenstein was the pick of our guest today, Mayor Hawthorne. Once upon a time, he was a hip-hop DJ out of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
That's
and
right.
Shout out to Ann Arbor, city of my birth.
Hey.
In 2005,
hey.
The artist, formerly known as DJ Haircut, came out to L.A., and that led to his transformation into the smooth-singing, funk-making talent we now know as Mayor Hawthorne. Besides the 4 solo albums he's recorded, he's also been part of the Tuxedo Duo with Seattle producer Jake One. And memo to self, we need to get Jake Weezy on this show, man. Let's make that happen.
For sure.
As well as one half of the post-punk and funk duo Jaded Incorporated alongside Ypsilanti's 14 Karat. Fun fact, Jaded Inc.'s 2014 album, The Big Knock, was released by Casablanca Records.
Yeah, hey.
Long, long time
right.
home to Parliament's recordings, including The Clones of Dr. Funkenstein.
Correct.
Mayor, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Man, thank you guys so much for having me.
So this is very surprising to think about, but even though we've been recording the show for now over a year, this is the first time we've ever really dug into the P at all.
Yeah.
So this is the first P-Funk recording that we've got to talk about. So I thought we could start by going around the horn and just talk a little bit about what was our introduction to the sound of the P.
Wow. Definitely getting stoned in the Huron High School parking lot somewhere. Yeah. I want to say that this album, The Clones, was my first introduction to Parliament.
Interesting.
It was possibly Funkadelic, Let's Take It to the Stage. But one of those too. I mean, this was a really formative record for me.
Yeah.
I'm so honored to be the one to do Parliament.
Our first one.
Morgan, how about you? What was your introduction to P-Funk? P-Funk?
Well, I've said a few times I didn't buy P-Funk until 1979. I saved up some of my money. My brother and I walked down the street to the corner of Sentinel and La Brea there in Inglewood, and I bought Knee Deep. The debate was, am I going to buy a Prince record or Knee Deep? And it was Knee Deep because Prince was naked on his album. I knew I couldn't bring that in the house. Right. We're churchy. That wasn't my introduction. That was just the first time I bought.
Yeah.
My introduction was the Mothership Connection. Mm-hmm. And my Aunt Jean, my Uncle Kevin bumped P-Funk on a regular basis. And as a kid, just the album art for me was just like, yo, I didn't know what a concept album was then, but when I grew up, I thought maybe this is a concept album. So that was my introduction, my uncle and my aunt bumping that strongly in the house.
My memory, as I have said many times on here, not that great, but I'm almost certain that my introduction probably did not come through P-Funk directly. It really came through samples and someone who in the late 80s and early 90s,
right.
Hip-hop was pretty much the only music that I was listening to.
Yeah, Dr. Dre.
And even before that, I mean,
Digital Underground,
exactly.
Who was basically an entire group of Parliament samples.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So between people, up and down the West Coast, the P-Funk was such a heavy, heavy influence in West Coast hip-hop. And normally this would be, I think, a conversation topic to save for maybe later in the convo. But since I've already introduced it here, what is it about that connection between the West Coast and not just hip-hop, but really West Coast funk drew so heavily from George Clinton and his whole bevy of talents? What is it about those coastal connections? Because P-Funk itself has its roots in New Jersey, in Detroit, in D.C.
Right.
But somehow I feel like L.A. is where, and Oakland as well, is where it's really lived and survived over the decades. And
the West Coast.
What's up with that?
Really embraced the funk for some reason. Yeah, I don't know. It's something I've been trying to figure out, honestly, for like my whole life. Or at least the last 10 years that I've lived in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It is really something that the West Coast just picked up and ran with. I mean, without George Clinton in Parliament, you don't have West Coast rap, basically. I mean, you don't have Snoop and Dre. You don't have Ice Cube. I mean,
yeah.
You really, it's such a powerful force on the West Coast. They really embraced it over here.
I just always knew funk to be a part of West Coast hip hop. I mean, Ice Cube sampled Funkadelic on Steady Marvin.
Whoa! They say the bigger the headache, the bigger the pill, baby. Call me the big pill.
God damn! The bigger the cap, the bigger the pillin'. And when dealing with the lynch mob, you gots to know Steady Marvin is not just the name of this jam, but a way of life.
N.W.A. sampled.
You. Wants to get fucked up.
Yo, what's up, niggas and niggas? If you ever have a problem like this, don't call that broke-ass nigga you got. And don't call that sorry bitch that don't give a fuck about you anyway. What you need to do is call 1-900-2-COMPTON.
Well, all right.
And you heard funk in the streets. You heard it in the roller skating rink. So it just was. I don't know what it is about the musicianship of Funkadelic that lent itself so much to West Coast hip hop or what we liked about it. But it was just a given fact. And it was just a given fact for me that you would hear that stuff and you would hear those samples.
Yeah.
I think, California, I think, is definitely home to a lot of unique individuals, for lack of a better word. And my dad would say fruit and nuts. But I think that is a big part of it. I mean, a huge draw of Parliament to me was that they were kind of this misfit bunch of weirdos that didn't fit in to other genres of music, and they created their own imaginary, incredible world of creativity that, I think a lot of people in California may be related to.
Sure.
I like that theory. And Mayor, I'm wondering, as someone who grew up in the greater Detroit area, and given, again, the deep, long traditions and roots that Clinton and his groups had in the area, was this something that you really grew up around? In other words, would anyone growing up in your era in that greater Detroit area, would P-Funk have had to have been part of this, the soundtrack of that? Or was it still in some ways maybe more on the side in terms of what you would have heard on mainstream radio and going out to clubs and whatnot?
It was definitely a huge part of me and my friends, my circle of friends. It was an enormous part of our lifestyle, but we were on the periphery. I mean, you know, I think a huge attraction of it for me, again, was that I was not the popular kid in school. I was kind of a nerd, you know, I was studying computers and stuff, so, and making, you know, weird music and in little jam bands, and that was part of the appeal to me, was that they were different, and they were so unabashedly different.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, this is fun. Like, it's cool to be different.
Yeah.
I don't know much about, or I didn't know much about Detroit radio until later. And much of what I know about it is through talk and conversation and scholarship about the Electrifying Mojo, because I like Detroit techno, right?
Right, sure.
Always thinking about the Belleville Three.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you were hearing on the radio then, and how was Parliament a part of that?
Well, I unfortunately am a little too young for Electrifying Mojo. I missed that era by a hair. But you know, when I was going to the Detroit clubs, it was all about ghetto house and what we called booty music, mm-hmm. and, you know, ghetto tech, DJ Assault and DJ Godfather and Disco D, who actually, Disco D, seeing him DJ at the Trotter House in Ann Arbor and seeing him scratch 150 BPMs over booty records, like, flawlessly, that was what made me want to become a DJ myself. So, yeah, but it was really all about ghetto house and ghetto tech, which, you know, some of it was definitely funk-oriented, you know, funk-influenced. It was funk records that were, like, pitched up +8 to... You know, they would take, you know, whatever, guitar loops of funk loops and then just pitch it up to, you know, 150 BPM. So it was...
Yeah.
And everybody would go crazy to that stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
That was what we listened to in the club in Detroit at 2000s.
Yeah.
You're the first person that I think I've heard cite this as one of their favorite Parliament Funkadelic albums. Usually people will throw out Chocolate City.
Mothership Connection.
Maggot Brain.
Yeah, Maggot Brain. Right.
Why this one? What makes this one
this
special
This is
to
the
you?
One. I mean, I think a lot of because this was like my introduction to it, but also I just think this is the most perfect record of theirs. I think it
High
is.
High praise there.
I think, I mean, it's just, to me, it's like a perfect album, which, I mean, there are very few of those out there. I mean, you got Nas Illmatic, you got, you know, Michael Jackson Off the Wall, yeah. Prince Dirty Mind. Like, this is a perfect album to me where there is no skipper cut. Like, every song is incredible, and it's short and sweet and concise.
Yeah.
And the message is so clear, and it's just... It hit me hard. I mean, I really fell for this record super hard immediately.
Let's funk around.
You were saying that you were listening to this, or your introduction to it came in smoking out in a parking lot. In
Yeah, definitely.
So why was it this album? Because obviously you did not hear this in 76 when it came out.
No.
So
definitely
of
not.
All the different P-Funk albums, how was it this one found its way to you?
I don't know. This one, definitely the sound of this record, I think, is one of the best. Also, it was one of the better recorded albums. It was a little later... I think Mothership, was 75, right?
75, yeah.
So, I mean, Mothership sounds great, too. This record, man, there's something about the recording quality and the sonic quality of this record that's my favorite of all of them. And it was in that kind of weird limbo land before, I mean, it's like kind of pre-disco, but not quite Uncle Jam's Army, where it was where they brought the big clap in. and it was more dance. You know, this is not, it's not really a dance record.
Yeah, you can get down to it, but not in the way that you're
talking
about.
It's not really a dance record. It's funk. It's like, it's this weird, really, really unique sounding funk record that just created its own genre. I mean, there's just nothing like it, which I think is what really makes it great to me.
I think you get grabbed from the start, too, because when you get to the prelude, you're like, oh, damn, the funk is at stake.
Oh, yeah, no, it's,
you know what
it's
saying?
Dramatic. Yeah.
It is, you know?
Yeah.
What's that? Was that Gary Scheider's voice? You're like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So you're drawn in immediately from the outset.
Yeah, it's
so.
Like a movie. I mean, you guys compared it to Star Wars before, but this is pre-Star Wars didn't come out till 77, right?
Right, right.
But this was Star Wars before Star Wars.
That's it. That's it.
George Lucas, George Clinton.
Right? Hey,
coincidence?
Hey.
No. I mean,
Bob Gunn, lightsabers,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying? All in the same family.
Yeah, we're going in right now.
Yeah.
Mir, I don't know how deep of a Clintonologist you are in terms of, you know, how much you've sat with the entire catalog.
Well, I don't know. We'll see.
But I'm curious, like, where do you see this fitting in into the general evolution of Parliament and Funkadelic across the 70s? Because if you listen to where they started, like with something like Osmium to like Motor Booty Affair by the end, I mean, it's not like the same album every single time out.
No,
there's definitely an evolution there.
It's a real evolution, yeah. And they start out much more of like a rock-oriented project with Funkadelic, and then as they progress along, as it gets later and later into the 70s, you get more and more dancey, and it becomes more electronic, more synthesized. And this is, yeah, like I was saying before, I mean, part of the appeal of this record, I think this is where they really just nailed it as far as something really unique. I mean, obviously, Parliament's always done, you know, their own thing, but I just don't think this record sounds like anything else. I cannot think of a single other record that sounds like this.
Wow, okay.
I can't think of a single other band that sounds like Parliament Funkadelic. And
sure, but I mean, a lot of people have tried.
For sure. For sure, for sure.
I mean, even in Atlanta, the Outkast and Goody Mob and Organized Noise, I mean, they drew so much
heavily
from Parliament. I mean, they wanted to be the new Parliament Funkadelic. And you don't have, without George Clinton in Parliament, you don't have Outkast or Goody Mob.
I'm glad you bring that up, because we had Joy in here. She was our pilot episode guest, and she talked about Betty Davis. But every time I hear any Parliament Funkadelic and I hear the Brides of Funkenstein, or in this case on this album, Taka Boom, right, it just sounds like Joy. And so I remember all those background vocals that she did.
Yeah, all the amazing
Outkast
harmonies.
And,
yeah.
Yes, indeed. Her and Erica. So. One of the things that makes this album great to me is the background vocals, is the guys together sound like just a choir of funk. And then Taka Boom, of course, who's Chaka Khan's sister,
right,
killing it with the backgrounds,
yeah,
as well.
Smashing,
so.
Yeah.
One thing that also comes to mind, too, and this is not the best form of thought, but Mayor, you were talking earlier about just how P-Funk presented itself was as this band of misfits, and just the creative energy behind it. And you think about Black music in the 1960s, where the defining outfit would have been Motown. And that's everything. It's a machine. It's
right.
An industry. It's run like clockwork, thanks to Berry Gordy and his team.
It's extremely professional, yeah.
Right. With Clinton, it's not that they're not professional, but that's not – I mean, obviously, there's no way he could have made the music and have the kind of catalog that they put together if not running some kind of pretty good ship. But how they outwardly portrayed themselves was as wacky, as weird, as taking ideas as far as they can go, regardless of how it might play out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for that reason, that's part of the enduring appeal of them, especially – it doesn't matter regionally. That's why people in Atlanta might take inspiration from it, is that they were and still remain a model of Black creative collective energy that I don't know if they don't get enough credit for it because it's not like P-Funk is obscure by any means, but I think it's an element to it besides them being fun, which is a big part of it. But it's also that what they bring to the table in terms of this representation and a manifestation of black creative energy is something that, especially on the mainstream level, there's not that many other examples that are at that stature.
No. And to be able to do it across albums, they never really varied from that. Pretty much every album, Parliament Funkadelic, they're all dressed as this group. It's like they sold Afrofuturism. They sold this whole cosmic free thought
right,
thing.
Right.
And you can't create these characters like the Wizard of Finance or Sir Nose without looking the part. And it wasn't just kitsch either. They're selling this world where the funk is free, where music is free. And music is the only way that you're going to get free, especially funk. So I bought it album after album.
Well, they tried, actually, to do the professional Motown-style doo-wop thing
with the Parliaments
right.
previously. And I read in George's autobiography that, you know, they would show up for a gig and, like, nobody would have their bow tie tied right or, like, someone would always be screwed. I mean, they just weren't they realized that that wasn't for them, that they weren't good at that. And actually, he went back later on and re-recorded a lot of his earlier doo-wop songs in funkier Parliament, funkadelic versions.
Sure.
Yeah.
And some of those are amazing. The goodies are gone. Yeah, what a jam. I mean, and that was
sure.
Later on. There are actually multiple reincarnations of that song where he brought it back and did it in progressively more and more weirder, funkier arrangements.
This definitely makes me think of, I think it was a 1968 single that George Clinton recorded with an artist named Rose Williams on Funkadelic Records. And I think, I can't remember if this is before the Funkadelic name as a band existed, but it was on Funkadelic Records. It's called Whatever Makes My Baby Feel Good. And it is very much in, as Mayer was talking about, in much more of a Motown vein. And for people who are familiar with the P-Funk sound, it's hard to reconcile this.
A testament to how great of a writer he was.
We'll be back with more of our conversation with Mayer Hawthorne on the clones of Dr. Funkenstein after a brief word from a couple of cool Max Fun podcasts. Don't go anywhere.
The Greatest Generation is the most popular Star Trek podcast in the world.
A pretty dubious distinction, but it's true. We've blasted through all of Star Trek The Next Generation, and now we are blasting through Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Come find out why millions of people have listened to our show and the Star Trek industrial complex ignores it.
Go to MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts and look for The Greatest Generation.
I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne, and justice is within your reach.
My mom refuses to take my phone calls.
My boyfriend says I should take our cats with me to graduate school, but I think he should keep them.
In the court of Judge John Hodgman, justice rules. My partner's board game collection is out of control.
My sister won't stop stealing my clothes.
I'm Judge John Hodgman. I'm tough, but fair. I'll bring you justice, and I'm only a click away.
Tipping, automotive etiquette, siblings, roommates. If you've got a case, go to MaximumFun.org/JJHO. Judge John Hodgman is tough, but fair.
Tough, but fair.
Subscribe to the podcast today.
Judge John Hodgman rules. That is all.
Welcome back to Heat Rocks, where we're talking about the 1976 Parliament album known as The Clones of Dr. Funkenstein with our guest, Mayor Hawthorne.
Let's get into some of these tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Did you listen to the album start to finish?
Oh, I've listened to that album more than any other album in my life, probably. Whoa. Yeah.
Did you go track by track, or did you get stuck on any one?
I mean, that one I can definitely run. I can run that one all the way through. I could probably just sing you the whole album front to back right now.
That's Well, I want to talk about one of my favorites on here, which is Gaming On You.
Gaming On Me.
That one is fire.
Why you gotta be... Actually, Oliver, I gotta ask you, as a person, what is your ethnicity?
I'm Chinese American.
Okay, so as a member of the Asian persuasion, how do you feel about the intro to Gaming On You? I mean, it's done in a very funky way. But
sure.
And I always kind of was
cringe
like,
a little bit.
Yeah, I was like, well, I mean, but, you know, then Parliament was always such a multiracial, like, inclusionary thing. But that always did strike me as kind of funny that they opted to start the song with that. And it's not like it comes back or anything later in the song. It doesn't really have anything to do with it.
Bottom line, it's not as bad as the Fugees takeout skit from the score. So as long as it's above that threshold line, I'm fine.
You got a point there.
Fair. Yeah, valid.
You got a point there.
Very valid.
Yeah, you got a point there.
What a jam, though. I mean, yeah, that... That just, I mean, it's the set off, it's the jump off.
It is.
It just gets you moving immediately. There's no denying it.
This is so funky. I mean, the horns, my God.
The horn arrangement, Maceo and the horn arrangement, Fred Wesley. I mean, yeah, just the best.
I mean, my God. That's one thing about this album. The whole album is the musicianship. I mean, you got a hell of a cast of characters, but there's so many horns on this album. It's not like the synth gets lost. You don't lose Bernie. You know what
no.
I mean? But it's just like the horns give it such an identity, especially on this song, and this is a head nodder. So I think, Oliver, you were saying earlier, like, you don't really dance to this album. Like, you can't really groove.
That was his point.
Or your point. Yeah. But it is a head nodder.
It's not a dance record, per se, but you do... You have no choice but to dance.
You got a two step.
Yeah, I mean, I can't not dance.
You get a two step in there.
So, is this your fire track off this LP?
I think if I gotta pick one, it's probably the title cut. Mm. Well, all right. Oh man, yeah, this is just the embodiment of this universe, this unique universe that they created. I mean, it's so visual and just so different, and really just incorporates everything that I love about it. Swift flipping, ego tripping, and body snatch. Coming to you directly from the mothership, the last leg of the P-Funk.
It also makes me think of who invented what I've termed over the years as squeegee funk. Was it them or was it Ohio Players? Because I always think of Funky Worm.
Oh, that's funky, that's funky.
Junie Morrison, who... basically was that element of the Ohio Players, then went on to write not just knee deep and
that's right.
You know,
sure
do
enough.
Perform a lot with George in Parliament. Yeah. So they're all Ohio kids. So. Right.
And that squiggly sound is just such a signature.
I believe that is a synthesizer called the ARP Pro Soloist, which I actually used extensively on my last record.
There we go.
I love that synth.
Because, as I mentioned earlier, my entry point into P-Funk was really through the samples. For me, the fire track on here has to be Do That Stuff.
Do That Stuff. Oh, Do That Stuff.
This is a jam.
You got nice and smooth, funky for you, which I think was, if not the first, was certainly the most prominent. Though I got to give it up to my girl Yo-Yo, who used this intro synthesizers on, I want to say it's Mattress.
Okay.
Either way, like this whole song, the opening drum break, again, the opening synths. Mm.
Everybody want to play, but everybody's not a player. In my ear with that. And say the same old shit, but you try to come new with it. Talking about what my man gotta do with it. He gotta
didn't K-Dot use this too?
Turn the headphones up, Ali.
Definitely one of the more sampled drum breaks in the history of rap.
That's funky.
What's your fire track, Morgan?
Because I tend to go for the more sexier themes.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with I've Been Watching You.
I've been watching you. The way you move.
Yellow sex.
There's a body roll in my spirit right now. We ain't got enough room or time in here, but yeah, that's one. That's just so funky and so sexy.
It's the one kind of down tempo moment on the record too, and everything else is so up and fun and party, and that is kind of the one, sexy little break in the. In the album, which is, again, it's just like, it's a perfect album.
I don't know what either of your experiences were like in this regard, but I very distinctly remember this being this moment in probably around the late 90s, early 00s, kind of the early wave of internet message boards for hip-hop fans and record collectors, where it felt like there was a real backlash against P-Funk, and where, because Parliament Funkadelic had so defined like the meaning of funk, in the same time now, again, in the about 15 years ago, or a little bit more than that, where you're now discovering more obscure gut bucket funk 45s that has a very sparse and underproduced sound compared to what you have with P-Funk. It was like P-Funk became really uncool. It became corny. It went from being this incredibly dominant sound, and then amongst maybe like a fringe or marginal community, they were like, yeah, that's not real funk, or it's corny funk, or things along those lines. I'm wondering, was that stuff that each of you also experienced in terms of the again, I guess I call it a backlash against P-Funk in a way because it became so dominant within popular music during that time?
Not in my experience, because Parliament and Parliament Funkadelic was always cool. It was part of the fabric of black culture. It was what you could expect to hear at barbecues, get-together. Somebody was going to have one of the albums or play the hits. Mm-hmm. And so it was always cool. I mean, their whole get-up, their costumes, even that was cool. The fake noses and all that kind of stuff. We just accepted that as cool. And later on, getting into bands like Cameo and stuff like that, to me, that was part of the same thread.
Oh, sure.
I just never separated it. So it never became uncool. But I think for a lot of people, It wasn't until hip hop bringing it back, bringing them back, and specifically Ice Cube out here, that it became cooler. Mm. But for me, the coolness never went away.
Yeah. I mean, Parliament, Funkadelic, undeniably cool, I think, always. But they were definitely cartoonish, and it was glam. And I think there were a lot of people later on who were heavily influenced by that, that took it and ran with it and made it, you know, more, did a cornier version of it. And I think a lot of people, when they think of funk, if they're not funk music people, they think of this like cartoonish kind of corny caricature of it. And I think that, you know, I understand where that stereotype comes from, but
it's bad jam bands. They kind of ruined it. You know, people would just, you know, they pick up the bass or start doing that, the slap bass thing, even though I think that's more of Grand Central Station rather than P-Funk specifically. Yeah. Sure. But nonetheless, like the ways in which funk does become a caricature, P-Funk is maybe didn't create it in a, obviously not in a deliberate way, but it is the progenitor of that.
For so sure, yeah.
That's part of it.
Sure.
That's where it comes from.
And
I
don't think that you'll see a lot of people now, grown folks, you know, dressing up as Parliament in the same way that you see Kiss fans still have on the paint and all that kind of, you know what I'm saying?
Like, point, yeah.
And the you know, those dudes were dressed up, you know what I'm saying? They had their look.
Yeah, I mean, you got David Bowie and, you know, that's
sure.
The whole glam rock scene and, you know, it's a whole.
I think the glam observation is spot on. And I do think partly it explains why, to the extent that glam doesn't sit well with people for a lot of reasons. I mean, certainly we can get into like the gender politics around and other stuff, but I think the way in which glam unsettles people who like stuff that is more kind of conventionally, I don't know, for lack of a better word, you know, masculine or conventional. It's just, yeah, I just think of it as glam as being very anti-conventional in that, in that sense. And so there's something about glam, whether it's in rock, whether it's in soul, whether it's in funk, et cetera, that does stir the waters for people and it brings up whatever certain feelings. And so that might be part of it too. Now, Mayor, you certainly are you're no stranger to cover songs. And I'm wondering, I'm trying to think of your catalog, have you ever covered a P-Funk song?
I don't think I've ever had the balls to cover a P-Funk song. That's something that would be really fun to do live, though.
Yeah.
And maybe I'll throw that in on the next go-around on tour.
If there was a track off of this album that you would deign to take on, what do you think it would be? What would you want to try to tackle?
You know what? I wasn't personally in this band, but there was kind of like two big bands coming up in Ann Arbor when I was in high school, and the rival band, who actually a member of that band is now my manager.
Okay.
What? So that, but his band they actually covered Getting to Know You in their band, and they crushed it. I mean, it was awesome.
That's
they
did a jam
it.
Too.
They really jammed it every night. It was one of the highlights of their set every time. I was like, wow, you know, these guys are the rival band, but man, that.
Right, you got to give it up.
You got to give it up for that.
Give it, yeah.
You
got
to give them props for that one.
Hitting me is how important the horn section was. And kind of an obvious point, but I feel like
it's
horns
really dominant,
have fallen out of favor in more contemporary music.
Yeah.
You just don't hear those big banks of brass.
Yeah.
And it was such a fundamental part of what made this sound appealing.
Yep.
Not just P-Funk. I mean, you look at every funk group in that era. The horn section was key.
It was, yeah. Definitely something that has taken a back seat in modern music, yeah. I think it's something that was so prevalent in the 60s and 70s, so powerful that when young people now hear horns, they immediately think, oh, this is old.
Mm.
Yeah.
And this is my parents' music or whatever, you know. So I don't know. It's a touchy one.
And not for nothing. It's not like you just have any old horn players either.
No,
you got Fred Wesley, you got Maceo, you got a lot on there. So.
Right, and I think, you know, George really was able to trust those guys to do the right thing on every song. I mean, I don't think he had to coach them very much.
Right. Do you think that this album was right on time, timeless, or ahead of its time?
All of the above. Mm. It's clearly all three. I mean, like I said, we're still talking about the same things 42 years later.
Yep.
Clearly way ahead, but also very right on time. It's a perfect record.
If you had to describe this perfect record in three words, what would those three words be?
Original. I mean, I think, I hate to say funky, but I mean,
it fits, right?
I don't know what other term would best describe the record. And then fun is number one,
which
is just something that, you know, and all of my favorite records have that word in common. Yeah.
That will do it for this episode of Heat Rocks with our special guest, Mayor Hawthorne. Mayor, it's been a while since you've released anything new, so what are you working on right now?
I'm working on a ton of new music. There's a lot of new music coming your way. I also do my own very unprofessional podcast every other week, and it's called Hawthorne Radio, and I just hit record and play records from my record collection for an hour, and I talk and, you know, get stoned, and then it's on iTunes. You can subscribe to Hawthorne Radio.
Where can people find you on the socials?
Mayor Hawthorne, M-A-Y-E-R, on everything.
Check him out, though. This guy's got really cool music, good music, and check out everything he's into.
Thanks, Morgan.
Thanks for joining us, man. This was really fun. It's a really fun album, just really fun conversation. Really
cool, man.
You've been listening to Heat Rocks with me, Oliver Wang, and Morgan Rhodes.
Our theme music is Crown Ones by Thess One of People Under the Stairs. Shout out to Thess for the hookup.
Heat Rocks is produced by myself and Morgan, alongside Christian Duenas, who also edits, engineers, and does the booking for our shows.
Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and our executive producer is Jesse Thorne. We are part of the Maximum Fun family, taping every week live in their studios in the Mothership neighborhood of Westlake, Los Angeles. We would like to thank all of our 5-star iTunes reviewers, but we don't have any new ones. If you haven't had a chance yet, please, please consider leaving us a review. It's such an important way for new listeners to find us and lets us know how you feel about the show. We also wanted to thank all of our social media fans and family out there, including the following folks. At Petty in Pink, love that. We want to thank Dem Black Mamas Podcast. Also want to thank DJ Jaffa. We also want to shout out Lost in Williamsburg, Frederick Smith. We also want to thank Chris is Floating in Space. Thank you so much. And as always, we really, really want to thank Santa Eric Reese. Santa has been shouting us out continuously. Also want to thank Warm Warmer Disco. And finally, once again, we want to thank Moritz Schwarzer for always holding us down. Thank you so much for your tweezies and your retweezies. One last thing, here's a teaser for next week's episode where we sit down with Chani Nicholas talking about Cyndi Lauper's She's So Unusual.
I was 8 years old when it came out, and so I am an MTV baby.
Yeah.
And her messages and the ways in which she was in the world, I think were so radically different than a lot of the other female role models that we had at that point. And so that time, and 8 years old is like a time where you're not really preteen, you're not teen, but you're like at that edge of something. Like a good part of your childhood is going, and a lot of the innocence of if you had it.
Well, you had a rough at 8.
I did. But a lot of her, like the sentimentality of her music, I don't know, it cut into my being and was just, it just was one of those artists that permeated that time in my life.
Sure. Boop 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 boop.
you know, whatever, guitar loops of funk loops, and then just pitch it up to, you know, 150 BPM. So it was,
yeah.
And everybody would go crazy to that stuff. You know, and everybody would go crazy to that stuff.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.